Welcome to the Public Morality. The life of Frederick Douglass embodies American greatness at its best. Born enslaved, Douglass rose to prominence as arguably 19th century's most gifted non-fiction writer, its greatest orator, renowned statesman, and its most photographed individual, all without the benefit of any formal education. Whenever America has moved closer to the vaunted more perfect union, it does so with Douglass's historical shadow casting over. As we continue our conversation on the life and legacy of Frederick Douglass, I'm joined by David Blight. Blight is professor of history of African American studies at Yale University and is the author of numerous books, including Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom, which won the Pulitzer Prize in 2019. Professor David Blight, welcome to the Public Morality.
Thank you, Byron. It's great to be with you.
Okay, let us assume, we're gonna start off a little fun here. Let us assume it's 1945. You are a screenwriter in Hollywood, and you're going to pitch Cecil B. DeMille on your film idea. You tell him about this young man born into slavery in 1818. He escapes in 1838 and without any formal education, 7 years later would write one of the seminal texts about slavery in his memoir in 1845. He ultimately becomes, at the time of his death, one of the most popular people in America who spoke at some of the world's most prestigious venues. Now, I suspect the only question is whether DeMille will allow you to finish this improbable and bridge overview of Frederick Douglass's life. Would it be fair to posit the creation of Douglass, though a profoundly American production, exceeds the imagination of most Americans? Your thoughts, sir?
Well, I love that challenge because I am involved in an attempt at a major film on Douglass based on my book, and it's been quite frustrating. Well, I suppose I would say, Mr. DeMille, your challenge here is to take this extraordinarily heroic life from slavery to freedom, from nowhere to everywhere, and not simply make it a rags to riches story like so many other American dream stories. Your challenge, sir, would be to make a film. Epic if you like, that's okay, but make a film about a very complex man. A brilliant person with language and words, and words were his weapon. Language was his power, both written and oratorical. So you've got the challenge here of the oratory and the written word. And written words don't make good movies, I know that. But you've got a challenge here to boil down an epic, heroic life into a very complex human being who had to overcome not only this burden of having been a slave with absolutely no formal education, and then working into a world of deeply religious, deeply devoted, mostly white abolitionists who embraced him, but from whom he found he had to eventually escape into a kind of independence, an independence of mind, and an independence of his professional life. Douglass will reinvent himself as an editor of his own newspaper and as his own kind of traveling itinerant lecturer. And I think, last but not least, Mr. DeMille, two things, Mr. DeMille. This is a person, not unlike some other very important American figures, who was constantly remaking himself, you know, whether you want to think of Mark Twain characters or you want to think of Bob Dylan or God knows, a host of other African-American artists and leaders who at least live long enough to do this. And the last thing I would stress is that if you're really going to show the complications of this man, you have to show how deeply steeped he was in Old Testament theology, in the Hebrew prophets, because the Hebrew prophets, the great voices of the Old Testament, were almost always Douglass's guide, or they were his source of stories, of rhetoric, of cadence. His language is born of his early reading. Not that he fully understood the stories of the Old Testament when he was young, who does? But it became the template for his ultimately almost incomparable power with the written and spoken word. Now, how you put all that on film, sir, is your business. But that's how complicated this man was. And then he also, I should say, lived a very complicated private life. Two marriages, likely one or two other important relationships with European women, but also, and more importantly, deeply important and sometimes very conflicted relationships with his four adult children, and how you will ultimately combine that private life with the public life is one of the great challenges, certainly of anyone writing about Douglass, and I think also of anyone trying to depict him in the medium of film.
Speaking on behalf of Mrs. DeMille, I think we're going to have to go to a mini series here. I just don't know. This is you can do this in 2.5 hours. I'm just
that's the problem with the film I'm involved with. It's only a feature. Two and a half hour feature doesn't let you do the whole life at all. You have to pick a piece, and that's difficult.
If you look at Douglass's formative years, as I know you have, sir, are there aspects of that time period that remained with him throughout his life?
Oh, yes. One can find it in the autobiographies. The first one, the narrative, the shorter one. The second one, My Bondage and Freedom, which he writes in 1855. That, by the way, I think is Douglass's long-form masterpiece. It's 430-some pages. But his 20 years that he spent as a slave, 11 of them on the Eastern Shore and 9 of them in Baltimore, are utterly formative for him in a host of, we might say, positive ways. That's when he gains his literacy. That's when he gains his love of language. He gets access to churches. He gets access to literate people. He gets access to that free Black community in Baltimore, which was absolutely crucial in developing his own imagination. But what also stays with Douglass his entire life are the kinds of brutalities, the kinds of humiliations that slavery involved. And by that, I mean both physical, but even more importantly, the mental interior brutalities, humiliations that slavery wrecked on any human being. Douglass, in some ways, never stopped processing that, writing about it, or using it. It was his material. It was his subject. And he was always more concerned, at least in his own case, certainly in the ways he wrote about it, with what slavery could do to his mind than what slavery could do to his body. There are psychological scars that remain with Douglass. That's never easy to pin down and precisely name, but a couple examples are that he always had difficulty trusting people. And why not? Who could he trust when he was a slave? It's the rare person. He didn't develop long-term friendships easily. He had long-term friendships, but he didn't develop them easily. And he brought, I think, out of slavery and then from other adult experiences in his post freedom or post-slavery life, he developed a hypersensitivity. Now, this could be common with lots of high-striving people, of course, but Douglas was hypersensitive to slights, whether those slights were racist slights or slights about his lack of education, lack of, you know, formal training. He did not like that, and he was prone to a kind of scorn and resistance to that. If he felt a slight from you, you would know it. He would tell you. So, you know, beyond that, I have some other speculations in my biography of Douglas about what stayed with him. But even as a literary figure, and he is first and foremost a writer and an orator, there are so many stories from his enslaved youth that he continues to employ, so many metaphors from his enslaved youth that continue to stay with him, and he uses over and over and over again throughout the rest of his life. Sometimes they change, but it is always his template, that 20 years. It also is, let's face it, he understood this. It's his great story. But, you know, what is Douglass's place in this American world? He's that former slave who became this astonishing intellectual, this astonishing orator. You mentioned earlier he became so famous and so on. That's true. But the fame was also a burden, a terrible burden at times later in his life, because everyone wanted him to keep telling that story about his slave past. Are you really who you say you are? Are you really that Frederick Douglass from the East Shore? He would run into people late in his life, or he'd get letters from them, who would remember reading his narrative and how it had affected them. And they could remember single episodes in his narrative from 1845, or a single character. Almost all of them were real people, by the way, Douglass's autobiographies, although being the good writer that he was, his autobiography is also good storytelling. But when he would encounter people like this, I mean, it had to be both moving to him, but also sometimes probably slightly troubling, because that's the story.
I'm glad you mentioned the writing, because I think going back to that opening with DeMille, we tend to think of Douglass as an orator, an abolitionist, but as you point this out in your work, he was a prolific writer. So how did that happen? I mean, I know there's something innate about being a good writer, but when you look at Douglass's life, how did he become such a prolific writer? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I do. I mean, it's certainly not all innate, as I know you know. Nobody comes out of the womb a born writer. They need training. They need work at it. Douglas starts writing, or attempting to write, even when he's still a slave, when he's very young. At first, though, he used language oratorically. It was a vocal language for him. He's already learning that in churches. He's learning to model preachers. He's modeling the homiletics of four different preachers he watched in Baltimore. He even practiced preaching among this, he called them his band of brothers, on the Freeland farm when he's about 17 years old. But when he comes out of slavery, he's not a good writer at all. I mean, his spelling was bad, et cetera, et cetera. But he was a prolific reader. And most great writers are endless readers. I mean, we can't write if we can't read. And, you know, I, for one, read my way into writing. Whatever I'm writing, I read my way into it on any given day. And that's what Douglass did. He was reading newspapers. He was reading abolitionist texts. He was reading sermons. He was reading William Lloyd Garrison's The Liberator from practically the day he arrived in New Bedford, Massachusetts at age 20. Now, it took some years before he, you know, mastered the sentences and the prose. But once he caught hold of this idea of writing, he found that he loved it. He loved the act of self-expression. There's a marvelous letter. It's one of my favorite of all the, you know, piles and piles of Douglas letters. It's the letter he writes in the late fall of 1844 to the editor of a magazine where he is about to publish his first published piece. This is 1844. So he's been out of slavery now 6 years. He's 26 years old. He's had a lot. He's been practicing writing and practicing writing. In fact, he started writing up some of his speeches. But he writes this note to this editor, and he sent him off this little piece, and he says, "Oh, though, to write for a book. Can I write for a book?" Of course, at that very moment, he was beginning to sit down to write the narrative. And that narrative, the first autobiography, 120 pages of it, is Douglas's attempt to basically put into prose form all the stories he'd been telling out on the lecture circuit for now 4 years, over and over and over. The fight with Edward Covey, Miss Sophia teaching him his letters, on and on and on. All these episodes of his youth, these metaphors about the black songbirds as his metaphor for freedom, and on and on and on. But he finds that now he can actually do it on the page. He can convert metaphors to the page, put it into a story, and by the way, make himself the main character of that story. Who's the great character of Douglas's narrative? Guess who? So, you know, he learned first to write in that first person, which is the way we often try to help young people or teach, you know, write something about yourself, just get it on the page. And that's how he started writing. But he had models too. He came to love certain great writers whom he clearly modeled. And as I've said already, he was all along modeling the stories, the metaphors, the cadences of some of the Hebrew prophets, especially the prophet Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and a couple of others. So, you know, the writing came later for Douglas than the oratory, but one led directly to the other. And then it should be said that all writing comes from repetition. All good writing comes from repetition. And once he'd written that narrative, what does he do? He starts writing public letters. Public letters. Public letters back from Great Britain in 1845, 46, 47. He knew, long letters, that he knew would be published in Garrison's newspaper. What does he do when he comes back from England? He immediately starts doing whatever he can to try to form his own newspaper. And he did. By the end of 1847, into 48, he creates the North Star out in Rochester. And from that day forward, in the 16 years that he published his own newspaper, he mastered a new form, and that is the short form political editorial. You know, the 500 word piece, the 1,000 word piece, or the 2,000 word piece. That's a different kind of writing than your first person than your first person memoir. But also, this man eventually masters about every kind of writing we have. And his speeches, especially after the mid-1840s, by the late 1840s, into the 50s, every major speech, and there's so many of them, exists in a text. He started writing them down, sometimes 20, 25-page text of these speeches. Now, he took them on the road with him. He took a text on the road with him, sometimes two or three different speeches. Now, he would stand up in, you know, in a church or a hall or where outdoors, and he would still, you know, ad lib and go off on tangents, of course. But this was a man who came to trust himself best when he could write it down first, which I've always admired about him. He wasn't just that preacher type who could walk into a hall, blow out the lights off the top of his head. He had worked this out on the page. And when you see those texts, and then you realize the reactions he was getting to some of these speeches, sure, he had flourishes, but those texts were written out first. So he had come to, you know, embrace and I think even love the written word as much as he had the oratorical word. And he knew that's where his power was, and really the only power he had.
Well, that's a perfect segue for my next question. So as for you as a Douglass biographer, does his written word, i.e. his biographies, are they a hindrance or are they a help to your work?
Well, I've always loved that question because they're both. His autobiographies are both a source and a subject. They have to be. They're clearly a source, especially for the early part of his life, that first 20 years. Although there are a lot of other sources that help us understand the Eastern Shore of Maryland and even the people within Douglass's stories. But they are very much a source of episodes, events, people in Douglass's life. And a lot of it we've been able to verify, at least the basics of names, places, dates, etc. But the autobiographies are also your subject, because you have to keep figuring out and you have to explain, as I try to do in my book, why does this man keep writing about himself? Why? Over and over and over. Three times. You know, the first autobiography, the second autobiography, the third one, which is fun, is the one called Life and Times, is done in 1881. Then he revises it again in 1892. So there are actually four versions of his autobiographical life. And that third one became very long, way over 500 pages. Why does he keep doing this? Well, one, it's the only story he had. It was a story he learned early on the country wanted to hear, country needed to hear. Secondly, I also, and I say this, I try to really develop this in the book, it's more elusive, but this is a man who was always trying to understand, who am I? What am I? And here's where we have to remember, he did not know who his father was. He knew his father was white and potentially one of his two owners. The likelihood is that it was either Aaron Anthony or Thomas All, but he never knew. And he spent a lot of energy and time trying to figure it out. So he doesn't know his paternity, for sure. And he barely knew his mother. He sees her last when he's 6 years old, and he had to invent these images of her. So he's an orphan, and he has that orphan's quest to figure out, well, who the hell am I? How do I know who I am? And then lastly, it's how did I get from there to here? In his own writing, he uses the Chesapeake Bay, of course. He's born on one side and he lives out his life on the other, to great fame in Washington, D.C. But you know, how did I get from that side of the Chesapeake to this side of the Chesapeake? How did I become Frederick Douglass? He's always actually probing that. I mean, one of the reasons he writes autobiographies is to keep probing, how did I do that? How did I get there from there to here? And what does that mean? And what's it going to mean for my people, his people, for Black people? You know, he had lived, in effect, the story of African Americans in the 19th century. He's not the only one, obviously, but he had lived it probably the most famously, from the experience of slavery through to emancipation, to the aftermath of emancipation, right on down to the beginnings of the Jim Crow era and the era of lynching. And here he was supposed to be the great spokesman of all of that history. So by probing the autobiography, over and over, he's got many motives in doing it. So it's they are sometimes in your way, though, no question, to get right to the core of your question. They're like pages, you know, running up and down in front of your face. And he's trying to protect himself, of course, as all autobiographers do. Douglass is hiding all sorts of aspects of his own life in those works. 1,200 pages of autobiography, and there is one mention of his wife Anna, to whom he was married for 42 years. There are very few mentions of his four adult children, because those relationships, though deeply important and loving, were difficult. There's a lot about his private life. Well, it's almost everything about his private life he does not tell us. It's very much a kind of ascension story of the heroic narrator at the center. And anyone doing that, of course, is manipulating you as a writer, inevitably. And by the way, 19th century autobiography was not like today. They didn't write tell-all autobiographies in the 19th century. Quite the opposite.
I hold Douglass's July 5th, 1852 address as one of the nation's greatest, impactful, underappreciated, and misunderstood in U.S. letters. How do you see it, sir?
Well, pretty much the same way, and I can put exclamation points on that.
I was hoping you would do that. Go ahead, well, answer.
It is the, in my view, and I've said this a thousand places, it's the rhetorical masterpiece of the American abolition movement, and it's a rhetorical masterpiece of American literature in the 19th century. It's 20-some pages long in a text form. And here again, make no mistake, Douglass carried that text to the lectern that day in Corinthian Hall in Rochester, New York. We have that text. That speech I have often likened to a symphony in three movements. And I'm aware that most symphonies apparently have four movements, but his has three. I mean, the opening of that speech, first five, six pages, is a welcoming of this audience, which is mostly a white audience on that day. Not entirely, but mostly it's mostly his friends and the kind of anti-slavery community of Rochester. He welcomes them to this 4th of July celebration on the 5th by setting them at ease, by telling them that this is the American Passover, he says. This is a day like no other day. It is the day of your independence, of the creation of this American nation, this glorious American nation. And then about five or six pages into it, he says, well, this is, you know, this Declaration of Independence that you we celebrate here today, it is the ringbolt, he calls it. It's just metaphor after metaphor to make them feel good and set them at ease. And then, as though he is throwing his fist down on the lectern, and I don't know if he did, I can't say that for sure, but it's like the hammer comes down. There's a pause. And he says, pardon me, why have you invited me here? Why me? On the day of your independence. And then he starts just raining down the use of the you and the your and the you and the your. This is the shift to the second movement of the symphony now, which will be the long movement, the powerful, hurtful, painful second movement. It's going to end up raining down on his audience like a hailstorm, all of the hideous, horrible aspects of everything from the slave trade and the slave ships through slave auction blocks in America to the hideous laws that are beginning to come out of the 1850s about slavery, especially the Fugitive Slave Act. But along the way, he says, this is the day that your fathers brought forth this country. It is your national independence. This is taught in your common schools. This is preached from your pulpits. You. And the tone has changed now. It's really changed. And he's accusing this audience of being part of this grand hypocrisy. That's what the speech is ultimately about. It's this grand terrible contradiction that is America. It's this place with tremendous founding principles, and he honors that. He says the principles, the four first principles of the Declaration of Independence, are fantastic. It's the practice that's so wrong. And then again, raining upon the audience, all of these images. And one of the reasons this speech works so powerfully, Byron, and I'm convinced of this, especially when it's read out loud, is because Douglass reaches for the senses in the second movement of the symphony. You hear the clanging of the chains on slaves' ankles. You smell the hold of a slave ship. You see the terror of a woman with child on an auction block. It's like he can manufacture rhetoric that makes you understand through all of your senses. And that's a rare writer. That's a rare speaker who can pull that off. And then there's my favorite moment in the speech, where he doesn't have to name his, and by the way, the Hebrew prophets are used about six times in this speech. They're all over it. It's not just the Hebrew prophets, it's also the Psalms. And my own favorite moment in the speech comes when he says, what we now need, his words were, what we now need is sacrilegious irony. Not just irony, contradictions, you know, and all that. Sacrilegious irony, he says. And he just floats into the 137th Psalm by the rivers of Babylon. There we sat down. Yea, we wept when we remembered Zion. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. For there, they that carried us away captive required of us a song. It's Douglass's way of saying to that audience, you've invited me here to sing, and I'll sing, but my song will make you hurt. My song will make you think, hopefully. My song will make you possibly act. At the end of this second movement comes this, I like to call it the Jonathan Edwards moment, because it's just like in the hands of an angry God. It's Douglass. He uses the metaphor of the reptile. He says, beware, beware, a reptile is coiled at your nation's heart. Okay, now, if you're listening carefully to this man, this gets to be terrifying. And then he says, break away, or the reptile will kill you. And then you see a pause in the rhetoric. You can literally, in the language, see a pause. And it's like he tells them, all right, dry yourselves off. The hailstorm's over. And the last short movement of the speech becomes Douglass. It's a very typical Douglass move. He kind of lets them back up, lets them up. And he says, it's not quite too late. Your nation is still young. He says, your nation is still malleable, changeable. And then he ends, astonishingly, really, with several verses of a hymn by William Lloyd Garrison, a poem made into a hymn called Go Sound the Jubilee. What's astonishing about that is that he's just had his huge breakup, personal breakup with William Lloyd Garrison, which has many causes. But the fact that he would use that text on the end of this speech, which is his way of saying, now, go act for the Jubilee, go act, go end slavery, do whatever it takes. So it's a speech that just has a rhetorical form that is flat out beautiful and powerful. It can be read in just sections. You can pluck quotes out of it, as most people do, or you can read it right through from start to finish and then just take a deep breath and wipe yourself off.
Well, I'm going to go someplace with the speech that may be certainly above my pay grade. I don't know about yours, but certainly above mine. One of my favorite aspects about the speech, It's when Douglass references July 2nd as the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Yeah. And my takeaway from that is that here is this guy who many people still find his existence hard to believe per our Cecil B. DeMille story early on. So he has, there's an additional burden on Douglass to have this unimpeachable history that that cannot be questioned. So when he lets the hammer down, as you talk about, his, you couldn't dismiss it with, well, he got his facts wrong. And so that's your thoughts.
Well, he didn't get any facts wrong. I mean, the speech is both about facts and not about facts. I mean, it's about American misuse of these facts. It's about the ways in which Americans have redesigned the Declaration of Independence to mean only white people. It's the way Americans have, in Douglass's view, misinterpreted it. But it's a little bit like the autobiographies, to your point, in that Douglass knew he had to get a lot of facts correct because he was always going to be under scrutiny, always under the judgment, you don't know what you're talking about, you can't have written this, or you can't have experienced that. The truth is, Douglass was, by this time, 1852, he's now, he's 34 years old, he's still young, but he's a tremendous reader, and he's begun to really collect books. And he knew a lot about the founding generation in America. He loved the Declaration of Independence, its principles. Popular sovereignty, the right, you know, the right of revolution, equality. These were the base, and above all, natural rights. These were the gold in Douglass's mind, without which this thing called an abolition movement had little, if any, hope. I mean, in America, if black folk were to have a future in America, something had to happen to make those principles include them. And this speech is a gorgeous, at times bitterly angry, and at times just artful appeal for inclusion into a set of principles that Douglass is arguing in this speech belongs to everyone. Everyone.
One of the things that I have told my students is when I had them read this speech, and many have not read it. I'm talking about graduate students have not read it before until I introduced it to them. Oh, sure. But one of the things that I love about the speech is that, in one hand, Douglass holds the hypocrisy of the American experiment. In the other hand, he holds the potential, the greatness, and the promise. And that's sort of the dual burden that I think is incumbent upon all of us.
Well, it allows people to love the speech. At the same time, its deep message is, at that time and to some degree since, it's a country with a terrible problem of its hypocrisy. It is kind of Douglass's way of saying, look, America, you have creeds. You say you are a creedal nation. And we are. We have creeds. Now, not every nation sets itself up with these creeds that they are bound to break. It's like 10 commandments. Which one are you going to break tomorrow? But these creeds, he says, are your burden and your opportunity. They are sitting right there on your neck. But they're also the reason this place has a chance to be something no other place has ever been, a pluralistic nation trying to, I mean, in 52, this is still hard to imagine, but trying to be a nation for all people living under law. That will come in a form because of the bloodletting of the war and emancipation and reconstruction, but that's a long way down the road. I think also people are today drawn to that speech. And you'll note I put the word prophet in the title of my book, and it took me a long time to get comfortable with that. But there is a certain prophetic vision in this speech. And I had to work hard to finally become comfortable using that word prophetic with Douglas, or prophet. He never called himself that. But I read a lot of theology, both Christian and Judaic, to come to understand what prophets meant in the tradition of the 19th century, and for that matter, even now. And this speech has all that quality. The prophets, according to Abraham Heschel, the great Jewish theologian, in a book called The Prophets, says, you know, prophets are put in this world to shatter us. Shatter us so that we can maybe learn how to remake ourselves. He says, you know, prophets, the words of prophets are not souvenirs. They're like bombs going off inside of us. Heschel also taught me to understand that prophets are not nice people to have lunch with. They're sometimes very difficult to deal with. This speech, if you read it carefully, not only made people uncomfortable in 1852, but it still can make people uncomfortable in reflecting back on its point. And I think that's one of the reasons it has had such a revival in the last, let's say, a couple of decades. It's often read aloud in public places on the 4th of July, in cities, towns, and so on, sometimes outdoors in parks. It's amazing. And I've been part of some of these readings, Inder and Jan. And it's beautiful to watch people hear this and listen to this. However they understand the place of slavery in America, they usually are seeing it through the lens of hearing it in the year 2020 or the year 2016, and particularly in this era now when this American experiment is in such trouble.
So if one reads King's letter from Birmingham jail, or they listen to the 1963 keynote address at the March on Washington, should they also see hovering over the shadow of Douglas and his influence on King's approach?
Well, you know, so many people being interviewed start an answer with the word absolutely. And I try to avoid that, but in this case, I'd say absolutely. To read King's dream speech is not only to see King in his power. And as many people will know, the first roughly half of that speech is a text, a carefully constructed text with that amazing opening about the check coming back.
Insufficient funds.
But the final parts of that are spontaneous. The dream parts of that are spontaneous because dreams are unfinished. It's the same with so many Douglas speeches. Douglas gave many speeches that are in effect, and I have a dream speech. Can this country be what it says it's going to be? Can it be again after emancipation, after it's been reinvented in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments? Can it be that again? And Douglas lives long enough, all the way to 1895, to see that being crushed. And yet he's still demanding in the last great speech of his life, The Lessons of the Hour, 1894, which is about lynching, for God's sake, he's still demanding that America still can live up to its natural rights tradition from which it was born. So you're right. Fourth of July speech works partly because it is this painful visitation on his audience of all the pain of the middle of that second movement. The history itself, the tragedy of the history itself, but it's also the promise of the ending.
When you've talked about Douglas in the Old Testament prophet, so I'm going to pick an Old Testament prophet here, And I'm going to pull from the book of Zechariah. And the prophet Zechariah talks about being a prisoner of hope. And when you consider Douglass at the time of his death, you know, we're post-Civil War, we're post-Reconstruction. The Reconstruction only went so far. So I'm sure there was a lot of frustration with Douglass. Would you consider him at the time of his death a prisoner of hope?
Well, depends on what we mean by that. But I think the answer is yes, because, in fact, Douglass took tremendous criticism. He took a lot of heat that last 20 years and more of his life from the next generation of younger Black leadership who said, Douglass, come on, man, you're out of touch. Get down off your pedestal, old man. That Republican Party isn't speaking for us anymore. And Douglass would always say, look, I know there are problems with what's happened to the Republican Party. But the Republican Party is the ship, all else is the sea. That was his metaphor. Because he had nowhere else to go. Douglass was, or became, even in the 1850s, a great pragmatist in the sense that he learned, this he had learned the hard way. Back when he was a radical abolitionist, he found this very hard to learn. But he learned that you had to use politics. You had to engage politics to get what you could, not always what was perfect, to say the least. And it's astonishing sometimes to realize how hopeful he could still be, especially in the 1890s, especially in that speech that's all about lynching. And it's a hard-hitting speech. It's actually a brilliant analytical speech about why lynching is happening. But he still ends on this idea that natural rights are like precious ore. It cannot be destroyed. They're always there. And you have to keep fighting for them. Now, unlike some others, he never bought into foreign immigration. He hated that idea. He thought that would essentially reject and violate the idea of birthright in America, birthright citizenship. Sometimes he was accused of just becoming too conservative, would be the word, about self-reliance and self-help and so on. I find that deeply troubling, especially what the American right wishes to do with Douglass today. Let's face it, the Republican right loved to love Douglass because he was then a Republican, very unlike this Republican Party now. But they loved to look to Douglass for all that self-help, self-reliance rhetoric. Well, what else was he supposed to do in a society that would enslave you, kill you, discriminate against you, and then maybe ultimately lynch you? How could you not engage in self-reliance? It's just absurd for people to cherry pick these aspects of his life, bring them into the present and make them mean what they want it to mean. But yeah, he was a prisoner of hope to the extent that, and here's where he is complex and complicated. If he ever gave up on that hope about America becoming some degree of its promise, what does he do with his own life? How does he explain his own life, which was always rooted in this hope that he could become something new tomorrow? He could never give up on that. Otherwise, he you know, all the explanations he had given to his own life wouldn't make sense anymore.
Professor David Blight, Yale University, sir, it has been an honor to be in conversation with you about Frederick Douglass. My sincere appreciation. Thank you for joining us on the public rally today, sir.
Byron, this has been great fun. Thank you for having me on.
The Public Morality welcomes your comments. You can contact me at byron@publicmorality.org. That's Byron, B-Y-R-O-N, @publicmorality.org. You can follow me on Facebook as well as Twitter. The archive broadcast can be found on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Prime, SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Those listening to The Public Morality on WSNC can also listen on its app. Using your mobile device, simply go to your application page, Search WSNC 90.5 and click open to listen from anywhere. The Public Morality is produced at WSNC on the campus of Winston-Salem State University. For all of us at the Public Morality, I'm Byron Williams.